Next is in the matter of Dwight Hugh Day. May we please have appearances?
Thank you. Christina Blunda from the Office of Attorney Ethics.
And Mr. Day is next to you?
Yes.
You will have the opportunity, if you would like, to address the court, and I'll give you a chance to speak with them after your presentation to see if you'd like to do so. Ms. Blunda.
Thank you. May it please the court, Chief Justice, Associate Justices. We're here today after a hearing before a special master at which the OAE proved by clear and convincing evidence that the respondent knowingly misappropriated client funds, engaged in behavior involving dishonesty, deceit, and misrepresentation, failed to cooperate with the OAE's investigation, and failed to appropriately maintain his trust and business account records. The DRB agreed with the special master that these violations had occurred, and both the special master and the DRB recommended the respondent's disbarment, and the OAE agrees. The respondent represented a client who was allegedly assaulted while in federal prison, assaulted by other inmates. The matter settled, and a settlement check was hand-delivered to the respondent's office on July 16, 2014. At the hearing, the respondent admitted that he knew that he had an express obligation to hold a client's settlement funds in his attorney trust account until they were dispersed, and that he had not done so in this matter. He further admitted that despite knowing this, one day after receiving the funds, he began to write checks to himself from the settlement proceeds and deposit them into his business account, beginning with a check for $3,500, which he deposited into his business account when the balance in the business account was only $37.66. So clearly there was a need for those funds. Within approximately a month of receipt of the $10,000 in settlement proceeds, he had dispersed $9,500 of the $10,000 by way of checks to himself that he promptly either spent or put in his business account and spent on business and personal expenses. On July 20th, just a few days after the funds had been received by the respondent, his client wrote him a letter requesting that the funds be deposited directly into his prison account. But by that time, the respondent had already dispersed $8,500 of the $10,000. And by August 13th, less than a month from the time that the funds arrived, he had only $500 left in his trust account on behalf of that client. Yet, in September of 2014, the respondent wrote to the client saying that his portion of the settlement proceeds would be deposited in the prison account in short order. And then in October, the account was only held $450.23. Yet in October of 2014, he again wrote to the client, said he would follow his instructions. And then in December, he wrote to the respondent and said, I don't know what happened to the check that I sent. However, there was no check sent. There was no evidence presented at the hearing that there had been a check written or sent. And the respondent admitted that he had a one-write system and he had stubs, yet there was no stub indicating that a check had ever been written or sent to the client. Finally, in January 30th, 2015, more than 6 months after the funds were received, one check was sent to the client for $1,000. And it wasn't until 4 months later in May, after the client wrote to the federal judge who had handled his case, and said to the judge, I think he may have misappropriated my funds, that the respondent sent $6,000 more of what the client had been entitled to. This is very straightforward and a knowing misappropriation. The respondent has offered three separate defenses to this matter, none of which hold water. One is that this is a negligent misappropriation as a result of his failure to maintain records properly. It's undisputed that he didn't maintain his records properly, but that had nothing to do with the fact that he spent the money that belonged to his client right away. There is nothing negligent about depositing $10,000 and then one day later starting to disperse it. There was a dispute as to the amount of the fee was his second defense. There was a retainer agreement which said that the respondent was entitled to a percentage of the settlement. No percentage was designated, it was just a percentage, plus costs and fees. The respondent initially said he was going to take $3,000, but then agreed to take $2,000 from the client as costs and fees. Yet he decided that he would instead spend the money. He said that at the hearing that he wanted his client to appreciate all he had done for him and allow him to take an equitable amount of the fee, which was close to half of the settlement proceeds. This was after he admitted on the record that he had agreed to take $2,000. And he basically said that he was holding the, he didn't use these words, but it was actually, I think, the judge's words, the special master, who said you were basically holding the client's money hostage until he appreciated what you had done. But the bottom line is he didn't do that. He didn't hold the money at all. He just spent it. So there were three problems with that argument. One, if there was a dispute as to the fee, pursuant to Rule 1.15C, he was obligated to hold the portion that was in dispute, keep it separate until the dispute is resolved. If there was a dispute, it was only $1,000. There was $3,000 that initially he said he would take, and then he agreed to take $2,000. So $1,000 could have been held, and the client notified that it was being held because there was a dispute. But he didn't hold the money at all. He just spent it. The second problem with that argument is that he was allegedly holding the entire settlement money back when, according to the rule, he was only entitled to hold the amount in dispute. And giving every inference to the respondent, the amount in dispute was $1,000. And the third part is that there is no dispute as to the fee because he admitted on the record that he agreed to take $2,000. And so the client was entitled to $8,000 of it. So when the respondent said that he had the right, even at the hearing, to take a third plus costs, it wasn't correct. He never had the right to take the third. And if he ever did, he waived it when he agreed to take the $2,000. His third argument was that he had $15,000 in cash in a safe that he held for immigration emergencies involving his family. But upon questioning by the special master, he admitted that they were never earmarked for the client in question and would have been spent had there been an emergency. And he also maintained no ledger system for those funds. More importantly, because substitute collateral, which we would call the cash in the safe, in a knowing misappropriation case has been rejected by this court numerous times, including both in the matter of Antoinette Wooten, who claimed she had gold coins that could satisfy the client, and in the matter of Richard Livingston, in which he claimed that he took the money out of the trust account because he was afraid that the bank was going to go belly up, and that he put them in his personal account, and that he always had money in his personal account that could have paid the clients. Both of those respondents were disbarred, and the same should happen to this respondent.
Any questions? Thank you, Ms. Blunden.
Thank you.
Ms. Adams.
The Chief Justices and Associate Justices, Attorney Dwight Day is an attorney who plans legal symposiums. He calls on his fellow attorneys to come and participate in these symposiums on the weekends and tells them that it is their duty to participate and to help to educate the public at large and the people of their rights. These legal symposiums are given at local churches and are open to the public. And Mr. Day is the type of man who sometimes would even cook and bring food to these seminars in an effort to provide these individuals with some nourishment as they learn about their rights. Now, while many attorneys may not take a case without the client first making some type of payment, Mr. Day will, in fact, accept these cases when he believes that there has been a grave injustice done to these individuals. Mr. Day is truly in the practice of law to help individuals. He works on most matters that many attorneys would shy from. This case that's the topic of this disciplinary hearing is, in fact, one of those. Mr. Day's practice does not in any way diminish the public trust in attorneys. In fact, it is the opposite, whereby through his actions, he inspires attorneys to fight zealously on behalf of their clients. In this instance, Mr. Day did not knowingly misappropriate funds belonging to the grievant Brian Nestor, who was, in fact, convicted of molesting a child and being in possession of child pornography. As a result of that conviction, no attorneys would take his case when he was raped in prison. However, Mr. Day saw past that and thought that it was important that he sought justice on behalf of Mr. Nestor. Unfortunately, as a result of that, a fee dispute arose, and Mr. Day did not engage in the appropriate steps to keep the fees within the his trust account or even deposit those with the court. But regretfully, he did, in fact, make the decision to keep the monies in his safe while he attempted to negotiate with Mr. Nestor the fee that he thought that he was deserving of as a result of the zealous advocacy that he did on behalf of Mr. Nestor. Mr. Nestor did benefit from the zealous advocacy of Mr. Day. He not only received the $10,000 settlement, but he received counseling outside of the prison system. He received services with respect to the STD that he contracted while he was in prison, medical services. He also received surgery for a hernia operation, and all of those things that he benefit from are indicative of value with respect to his legal case. It is our position that Mr. Day did not knowingly misappropriate funds belonging to Mr. Nestor. And it is also our position that both the OAE, the Special Ethics Master, and the Disciplinary Review Board, that they erred in their determination that there was clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Day did knowingly misappropriate funds belonging to the grievant. As cited in my brief, in the matter of James, this respondent used his trust account as a second business account. He used clients' trust account funds to advance costs to other clients, pay litigation expenses, payroll taxes, resulting in respondents being out of trust more than 20 times. Yet the Ethics Committee, the Disciplinary Review Board, and the Supreme Court determined that the respondent had absolutely no intention of misappropriating clients' funds for his own or anyone else's benefit.
Ms. Adams?
Yes.
I'd like to ask you a question about the particular facts of this case.
Yes.
Set aside whether there was a dispute over how much was to be paid between attorney and client, and whether records were appropriately capped. On July 16th, the settlement check for $10,000 goes into the attorney trust account. And on multiple occasions over the course of the next few weeks, $9,500 goes out of the account and is used for personal and business expenses. How is that not knowing misappropriation?
Well, at that time, Mr. Day did not realize that that was not an appropriate use for his business account. Shortly after law school, he had clerked at a law office briefly, but after that he went on and he started his own practice. And as a result, he just was not aware that that was an appropriate use for his attorney business account.
Are you suggesting that your attorney, your client, thought it was appropriate to take almost all of the settlement money and use it for his personal use and not for the client?
Not at all. It was Mr. Day's belief. I don't know if I could go so far as to say just cultural differences, because Mr. Day is a Jamaican national. But also, even setting that aside, as I stated in my brief, that it was merely just, I would say, laziness and just not a thoroughly thought-out decision, being that on a regular basis, Mr. Day, a practicing immigration attorney, was maintaining cash in his office
Wasn't that money, ma'am, for his client? It was a settlement for his client's case to recompense his client for his injuries?
I'm sorry, could you state
that? Wasn't that money earmarked for his client as a settlement for his client's pain and suffering for the lawsuit?
In fact,
how could he possibly think that the money that was for his client to compense him for his pain and suffering in the lawsuit belonged to him to use for his personal expenses? Where was the client's money going to come from then?
He maintained a safe in his law office where he would hold cash in the event that he had to post a bond.
Why didn't he use that cash for his personal expenses and leave the client's money in the account? If he had the safe for the cash that he could use for things, why was he using his client's money? How could he believe, whether cultural differences, Jamaica, England, that money was earmarked for his client? It was a settlement check to compense his client for pain and suffering to settle the lawsuit. Under what circumstances could he possibly think that client's that money for his own personal use?
Well, I just think that it was a difference in rationale. It was Mr. Day's contention at that time that it would just be a lot simpler to, instead of writing out an attorney trust check and then depositing it in the attorney business account and then withdrawing it from the attorney business account and then having that dispersed in cash and then taking that to a local post office.
But there are months there are many, many months that pass between the arrival of the settlement and the actual disposition of the monies to the client. Is correct? By the time the client gets the money, how many months have passed between the settlement and the payment to the client?
I think roughly about 10 months had passed.
Okay. So let me ask you a question about the nature of this lawsuit. Was this a personal injury lawsuit as opposed to a civil rights lawsuit?
Well, I believe it was both. He was injured as a result of the rape, but also his rights were violated by.
Did he file a Bivens suit or a 1983 suit as opposed to a personal injury action? Do you know?
It's in the record. 1983.
Yes,
I believe it is a 1983 lawsuit.
A civil rights, yes. Suit. And the reason why
the reason why I'm asking that question is I'm trying to understand the nature of his retainer agreement. But because if in a strict personal injury lawsuit, you wouldn't be able to, even if he didn't have the percentage inside the agreement, you can't take out more money than the rule permits, which is one-third after expenses are subtracted, correct?
Yes, and it was not Mr. Day's intention to take more than the third plus his expenses.
I asked you that because you said there was a fee dispute, and I'm trying to figure out, like, what do you mean?
Well, at the conclusion of the case, after the money was dispersed, Mr. Nestor did not want Mr. Day to take a fee at all. And so between telephone calls and correspondence, Mr. Day had forwarded correspondence saying that he wanted to take $3,000 as a result of him not having a detailed description of all of the fees that he had incurred through flying into Texas, paying for depositions, postage, hotel.
You would agree that under no circumstances was he entitled to $9,500 for fees and expenses, correct?
Correct, and it is not Mr. Day's position that he did take $95,000, but that he had the money there for disbursement for Mr. Nestor.
Is that in the money in the safe?
In the safe? Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Correct, and there
was
is
that
no...
Was that money in the safe earmarked for his client?
Well, he specifically had it there to disperse to Mr. Nestor. I know during the course of the our hearing before the special master did ask if there was a paperclip or something on the money. And during that hearing, Mr. Day said that he didn't specifically have a paperclip there. However, he did have the money there in the safe. And it was his intention through speaking with Mr. Nestor, whether it was via phone or as a result through correspondence, to somehow change Mr. Nestor's mind with respect to Mr. Day's entitlement of fees. However, Mr. Nestor did not want to disperse any of the money to Mr. Day, and subsequently he then wrote to the Office of the Attorney Ethics as a result of even Mr. Day taking only $3,000.
When he initially sent money to the client in January, he only sent $1,000. Isn't that correct?
Correct, because he wanted to make sure that Mr. Nestor actually obtained the $1,000 because through correspondence, Mr. Nestor had indicated that he had not received correspondence from Mr. Day previously. And initially, Mr. Nestor was located, well, he still remained, I believe, in Texas throughout his sentence, but all correspondence initially was going to Texas, and everything was sent to Texas, and then subsequently.
So as Judge Gallipoli asked you when you appeared before the DRB, why did it take so long to send the remainder of the money after January to the client in Texas?
Well, as I previously stated, Mr. Day was hoping to persuade Mr. Nestor with respect to settlement.
Wasn't the dispute over $3,000?
I'm sorry.
The dispute, as I hear your argument and I read the documents, was over a $3,000 fee.
Well,
so $7,000, no one argued, was his client's. And yet he sent $1,000 only. And the explanation I hear it is that it was easier to write himself checks, even though he had a safety deposit box where he could have used for his business and personal expenses without writing any checks. It was easier to write checks to himself rather than take the money out of the box because he was keeping that for the client. Is that your argument, as I understand it?
No, that is not my argument. I previously stated that the $1,000 was sent to make sure that Mr. Nestor actually received the payment because all correspondence was going to Texas. And Mr. Nestor had forwarded a letter to Mr. Day indicating that whenever letters and things are, or information that's sent within letters are forwarded to the Texas address, that most oftentimes the prison staff would dispose of that correspondence. And so then he directed Mr. Day to forward all payments to Des Moines, Iowa.
Why not the $7,000 then that wasn't in dispute rather than $1,000?
Well, he initially wanted to make sure that Mr. Nestor was in receipt of that. And subsequently, the $7,000 was sent. But in the interim, as I have stated, Mr. Day was trying to negotiate with Mr. Nestor with respect to his fee. And even during the time when the proceedings were going on before the Office of Attorney Ethics, Mr. Nestor was calling Mr. Day's office, leaving messages telling Mr. Day that he could make these disciplinary hearings go away if he would just still either give him the $1,000 or the $500. And that was, in fact, provided to the OAE and the court as evidence.
The $1,000 was sent at the very end of January 2015, and you said you wanted to see whether it made it where it should have gone.
Correct.
When did he confirm that the $1,000 was received? And what steps, if any, did he take in order to confirm that that first check went through?
Are you speaking of Mr. Day or Mr. Nestor?
Mr. Day.
Well, he had received a letter from Mr. Nestor. Mr. Nestor had subsequently written to the court that he had actually received the letter. It was in February, I believe.
So let's accept that. Why then, in February, didn't he send the next $6,000?
Well, all that I could offer to the court as a result of, you know, my discussions with Mr. Day is that he was, in fact, hoping to bring Mr. Nestor around to acknowledging the zealous advocacy that he had performed on his behalf and to see more of his value with respect to his
fees. By withholding the money?
I'm sorry?
I'm trying to understand that. By withholding the rest of the money, he's trying to negotiate with him his fee? How could that be appropriate?
Well, if Mr. Day had dispersed all of the
$10,000... Not all of it. The amount... So the amount in dispute was between... It was $1,000. You withhold, like, five other $1,000 in order to negotiate that? Does that sound right?
Well, initially, the dispute wasn't necessarily $1,000. It was with respect to Mr. Day receiving any money at all. And he was hopeful that perhaps Mr. Nestor, maybe it would seem foolish in hindsight, 2020, but he was hoping that Mr. Nestor would then see, you know, the value of his advocacy, all of what was achieved as a result of him bringing the suit, and would then agree to allow Mr. Day to take a larger fee. However, as a result of all of the back and forth between the parties, since it was difficult being that Mr. Nestor was, in fact, incarcerated and they couldn't just converse freely back and forth, and lots of times the letters would cross, Mr. Day did, in fact, consult with another colleague who had actually convinced him that it was probably the better course of action just to put the matter behind him and to just, forward the money to Mr. Nestor and just deem it a lesson learned, which Mr. Day did.
We understand your position. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No.
Would Mr. Day like to address the court, and you're welcome to speak with him privately before responding?
Thank you. Chief Justice, Mr. Day has decided that he would like to present.
Thank you. Please come to the center.
Mr. Chief Justice and the Associate Justices, this, I've never had to deal with anything like this, obviously. I never misappropriated his funds. When his funds came, it was deposited to my trust account. And then I wrote checks to move the money to my business account because I had to pay him by money orders. For me to buy money orders, I can't take a trust check to the post office to get the money order. Money orders are in increments of $1,000. Everything is going on at the same time. It is, he calls or I write, he's in Texas, it takes time to go back and forth.
Can you explain why you didn't send him money from the trust account?
Because you can only do it through the money orders. That's how it's done. You can't just send a check. It's in the correspondence. That's how the payment is done. He had indicated that his mail, he doesn't always get his mail because of the prison staff, the way they treat the inmates. Sometimes they destroy the mail or they're vindictive. And so he asked me lastly to send it to a P.O. box, to a drop box in Iowa, which is how he got the funds. Finally, the one money order was sent because I sent just one in order to confirm that he would have gotten it. Mr. Nestor and I, we were going back and forth on my fee. It was a $10,000 settlement. My total would have been $6,000-something. His would have been $3,000-something. I worked over 4 years on this case. Okay, I paid for everything.
I want to understand the nature of your retainer agreement. This is the reason why I asked your attorney the question. Because did you have either a Bivens suit or a 1983 suit?
It was a 1983 suit.
The reason why I asked that is because in a 1983 suit, it's fee shifting. Your attorney, you're entitled to fees. I'm trying to understand the nature of your retainer agreement. Maybe you can explain that to us.
The retainer agreement was written, looking back at it, it's as a personal injury sort of retainer. It was, because when I took the case, that was what I thought it was. After filing the case, though, it was in 1983, it was different claims.
But you never made you didn't make a fee application.
There was no fee application, Judge.
When we're talking about a retainer agreement, what's important is not just what you're saying, it's what the client. What is the client thinking his arrangement is with you? Go ahead.
And he knew it was the cost and the one-third. I believe what happened is nobody thought it was only going to be a $10,000 settlement.
Well,
in fact, it was going to be even less. I said, Andy, I worked on this case for 4 years. There has to be attorney's fees. There have to be, this is to the U.S. attorney. And that's why it went up in the first place. So it's...
Right, are you talking about out-of-pocket expenses or your fees were going up higher than you expected?
No. Repeat the question.
Are you suggesting that you didn't anticipate out-of-pocket fees going up high, or you didn't anticipate that you were going to be putting in so much time into the case?
No, neither. I didn't know where the case would take me. I'm saying that the client nobody thought that it was going to just be a $10,000 settlement. So
you thought it would be more?
Yes, but defendants kept being dismissed from the case because of various immunities. So it became a case that was going down the toilet, basically. And this is the end result. In all these years, I've handled millions of dollars. I would never misappropriate funds from a client, especially from $10,000.
Mr. Day.
And the money only came out because I had to get money orders.
All right, so let's talk about that for a second. So I want to get to chronology. You're concerned you had to get money orders and that your client was concerned because sometimes the money's not received, so you were testing it. Now, you received, as I understand it, a settlement check in July of 2014. The first $1,000 check you sent was January of 2015, almost 7 months later. And then no more money was forthcoming until he filed a grievance with Judge Kugler on April 2015, at which point you sent money, the other remaining money orders. So
that's not correct, Judge.
Well, that's what I'm reading from the record, sir.
I understand, but
the record's incorrect.
And I corrected that with the OAE and with when the letter came.
When did you receive a settlement check then?
No, I received a settlement check, Judge. What I'm saying.
No, when? Now I know you received.
The record is correct when I received it.
Okay, when did you send the first check out to your client?
That was in January
of 2015. So far the dates I gave you were correct.
Yes.
When did you next send? When did he file a grievance with Judge Kugler?
I don't know the exact date, but whenever
around
he
April
filed
15th,
it, Judge. Okay, this is what.
And then after that, Judge Kugler received the grievance. That's when you finally sent the remaining of the monies on May of 2015. Is that accurate?
No, Judge.
When did you send?
When I saw the letter, because everything comes out on e-court and federal court. When I saw the letter, I immediately responded to the judge that was not correct, and I'd already sent him the money, and he should send another letter correcting the court that he had received $7,000. So
When did he receive that?
I don't know when he received it. They have the dates on the money orders when they were purchased and sent, but exactly that charge that I even lied to the federal judge is incorrect, because I was correct. I had already sent the money to Mr. Nestor. It was not. I had no idea that he had even contacted the OAE, that he had written to the judge until I saw a letter. That had nothing to do with me that caused me to act a certain way, because I had no knowledge of that going on. Had that been the case, then, yes, I would agree with your argument. But that's happening behind the scenes. So when the first time I ever knew of this was when the letter was posted on e-court.
Okay, so just tell us the dates on the money orders that you sent before you say your client filed the grievance with Judge Kugler. Because if that's correct, then the dates should bear you out.
Okay, so the letter to Judge Kugler was entered on May 6th. That's, I guess, Exhibit 40 of the... So it was entered, it says May 6, 2015. The money order is dated May 5, 2015.
When you say,
and he wrote the letter. April 20th. So again, all this is happening in the background without my knowledge, with the OAE and the judge. It has nothing to do with my conduct, because I had no knowledge.
So let's talk about
he had contacted them.
So let's talk about what you knew. He sent you a letter, February 3rd, 2015, and he said, give me the rest of the money, or send the settlement proceeds to my father. You were aware of that in early February 2015, and yet you did not send or obtain money orders for another till May 5th. Why?
Again, Judge, I am trying. All I'm simply doing was trying to be paid. Mr. Nestor was not entitled. I sent him $7,000 and he still wanted another $1,000.
This is before
he was not entitled that much.
This is before you sent him the $7,000. As of February, you had sent him $1,000 of the $10,000 settlement check, correct?
Correct.
Why didn't you send him the additional $6,000 that was not in dispute?
No, but it is in dispute. My fee is in dispute. If I am believing that my fee is the cost and one-third, he is not entitled. Like, where, how am I, how is this, how is the attorney not protected?
Give us the number that you think you are entitled to under the retainer agreement. You said one-third. And cost. What was that number?
It would have been 6,000 and something, and he would have been entitled to 3,000 and something.
Okay, so
it's because of your flight costs and so forth, going taking depositions.
And everything for 4 years.
Did you take depositions in this case?
In Texas, yes.
Okay, so tell us what your out-of-pocket expenses were.
In this case, my out-of-pocket expenses were, I'd say, over $3,000 or a little over. That's for 4 years. From filing the complaint, paying for that,
okay,
to the end.
Okay, so typically it would be you would subtract that amount from the $10,000 and then the one-third would apply to the remaining. Am I correct? That's the way you calculate that?
Yes, Judge.
No matter how you slice it, didn't you owe him more than $1,000?
Yes, so we're going back and forth. It's not like this person was, at the end of a matter, the client comes into your office, you sit down with them, you go through the disbursement, you write a check from your trust account, and it's over. This wasn't one of those cases. I understand looking back that it could have been handled differently, but there was no misappropriation. And for me to get the money order, I have to go with the cash or a debit card. So that's the only reason it came out to begin with. It's not because I went shopping or I went whatever. I have money in my safe. It's easier for me to just take the cash and go. Once Mr. Nestor would have, agreed that this amount is a fair amount, he went from $0 to the attorney to $2,000.
Before this case, had you ever handled a personal injury case before?
Yes, Judge. I still do today. Never had any problems because, again, the client comes in, you sit down, this is the disbursement, you sign off, and it's done. This wasn't the case. I never had a client, after the settlement comes, it's going to change to this. Solas go through so much. I'm my own cleaning person, my own everything in my office. And to go back and forth with him after a settlement, when the case is going to go down the toilet anyway, and they only increased paid.
Some people on this bench are scratching their heads about is, assuming you do the calculations as you believe they should be done, you take your expenses, you subtract them from the $10,000, and then you use the one-third under the rules. That would equal what your client is owed. So some of us are wondering, why didn't you send that amount, the amount that you thought he was due, immediately?
And that's a very good question, Judge. I don't know why I didn't do that at the time. I was trying, again, to get to a number with Mr. Nestor as to how much he was going to get, how much my fees were going to be. And that's the only reason this case went on so long, because he is in jail in Texas and I'm in New Jersey. I also am all over the country because I do immigration work. So if he calls sometimes, I might not have gotten the call. I make arrangements to call him back. The letters go back and forth. It took time. I know it looks like, oh, my God, this attorney held on to his money for 10 years. Oh, he's trying to punish the client. I'm not trying to punish the client. I'm just trying to be paid. And
So I don't want to prolong this. You say you're trying to get paid. You have the money. You are paid.
Judge, in reality out there, it is another story. It's just another story. And, you know, it is very sad that my career, for 15 years, I've worked very hard and established myself. I've helped the community, done everything, including this case, which probably I should never have taken on, but for a colleague who sent it to me, because he went to jail, and for me to take it and for my career to end, the recommendation is by disbarment over this case, it's just unbelievable. Never have I been accused of misappropriation. That's not even in my DNA. It's not in my system. It has ruined my life for 4 years. I've had to live with it. Are you going to be disbarred? I was ready to walk away from the profession. I told them. I said, you know what? Just disbar me. I'm not a criminal. This was just crazy what I had to deal with emotionally. All these, are you going to be practicing? Should you take this case? You don't know where you're going, you know? For one case over this dispute from this, oh, we don't know what Mr. Day is doing with other clients' funds. I was turned upside down. All my records subpoenaed. They look at everything. There was no other matter. And this one matter that wants to ruin my life. And I just, you know, it's up to the court. That's what happened. I've never lied to the OAE. I've always told them the truth. They said, go create the records. I tried. I said, even if I recreate the records, that's going to put me in a worse situation because the record keeping wasn't on par. I did it a certain way because I did it by hand. That's how I learned after I passed the bar. They wanted it a certain way. I tried to do it that way. Oh, it's not correct. It's not sufficient. It is any judge who knows me, any lawyer who knows me, know that this is not me. You don't know me. You've never met me. So, you know, you're just going on the papers, but that's not me. And that's what I'd like to say to the court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Green. We'll take the matter under advisement. Court's in recess.